for argument this morning is Jamie S. versus Milwaukee Public Schools. Mr. Aldana.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. While the record in this case is lengthy and complex, the resolution of this really boils down to one issue. The class in this case should have never been certified for three reasons. First, the class definition itself, developed by the district court, which includes up to 10,000 students, is simply too indefinite. This was an issue addressed by this court in another putative but failed IDEA class action case in Adishanis v. Negley, which is squarely on point here. Second, the class fails to meet basic Rule 23 requirements of commonality and typicality. Third, and just as significantly, the plaintiffs and the class should not have been excused from the IDEA's exhaustion requirement, particularly based on a distinction which the district court created, which it dubbed as a pre- and post-determination distinction, which even the plaintiffs acknowledge has no basis in the law.
We do have a jurisdictional issue that we took with the merits of the case. Perhaps you'd like to address that before proceeding with the merits.
Sure. I'll dive into that. There is, and this court has asked us to brief this extensively, there have been dueling motions to dismiss. There is a jurisdiction on two bases, 1292A1 jurisdiction as an appeal from an injunction, or alternatively under the collateral order doctrine. And the plaintiffs initially challenged MPS's appeal as premature, claiming that the June 9th order was not an injunction. They've now flip-flopped, and they now concede jurisdiction exists. It's clear, though, that the June 9th order is an injunction. There's just no other reasonable way to view it. It lays out in a 72-page decision a highly detailed remedial scheme, and the district court laid out all of the components of it and the activities of the individuals involved with that remedial scheme. It ordered MPS to pay for an independent monitor, pay for the creation of a permanent, what it calls a hybrid IEP team, and ordered the activities of that team. And just that portion of the case could cost up to, depending on how many potential class members respond, $40 million to MPS just to do the initial class membership evaluation and eligibility determination.
In terms of whether exhaustion should be required, how would someone who was never referred for evaluation and never went through the IEP process exhaust his or her administrative remedies?
Well, the statute, both the IDEA and Wisconsin statutes, specifically contemplate that situation. They both refer to complaints being brought through the administrative process for a number of things, but the first one that's addressed in both statutes is identification. So it's clear that Congress did not intend, and the Wisconsin State Legislature did not intend, for the issue of identification, which includes the timeliness of referral, to be excused. As to the practical question, Your Honor, as to how a student who's never been referred, at some point they have to come forward, and they have to be determined whether they were eligible for a special ed evaluation and eligibility. And it's at that point where the Wisconsin statute specifically creates a extended statute of limitations. And it says that the parent or a student or a guardian can bring a administrative claim within a year after the student receives their notice of rights, which is at the outset of the referral process.
The district court did find that the MPS had systemic problems in identifying students who were eligible for special education and in timely commencing the IEP process for such students. Why wouldn't those findings support the decision to proceed with this case as a class action?
There are two reasons. One, for the students who are not timely referred, but that means they were referred at some point, and so they would have received their notice of rights. they then could challenge that. They would then challenge it from that point. As to the findings that MPS was not timely referring or not referring students for special education, the court never, and so we're not, at this point, with a fully developed record, we're not just looking at what the plaintiff's claims are in their complaint. We're looking to the record as a whole because, as the Supreme Court has said, it's a trial court's responsibility at all times during the proceedings to assess whether or not the class should be maintained. And the district court rejected our motion to decertify the class after at least phase two was completed, but it never distinguished between what percentage of students, what number of students were timely or denied a timely referral, as opposed to what number of students were never referred but should have been. And I think that's an important distinction, and without that factual basis, it should not have maintained the class.
Well, but it seems to me that the court did identify a series of systemic problems that MPS had in complying with its child find obligations. It linked those problems to delays in providing appropriate services to students who are eligible for special education services, and it explained how those delays adversely affected students even when they eventually do begin to receive special education. So why don't those findings support the district court's decision to impose liability on MPS?
Well, for a couple of reasons. First, the court never employed the analysis that's required under the IDEA and under this circuit's standards, most notably reemphasized in the Marshall case that was just decided last month, that there has to be a denial of a free appropriate public education, that is a loss of educational opportunity. And it never found as to either the students who were allegedly untimely referred, who were never referred, whose parents didn't participate in the initial IEP team meeting, or whose IEP went over the 90 days that was in effect at the time. It never made a finding as to any of the class representatives or any other class member that those students experience a denial of FAPE. And that's a prerequisite to making a liability finding.
A denial of?
FAPE, which is the acronym used under the IDEA for Free Appropriate Public Education.
Why wasn't the manager, isn't it a manageable structure, what Magistrate Goodstein set up to identify? What more would you suggest he needed to fill in the structure, Mr. Aldana, that he set forth?
Are you referring to the Phase 3 remedial order? Well, I think the Phase 3...
Well, I mean, I'm talking about the class, identifying the class.
But that's yeah. a large component of the Phase 3
right,
remedy,
right.
which I think shows under the Adishana standard of a class being easily definable or ascertainable, why this class should never have been certified.
Well, in that case, there was little or no evidence that the students with learning disabilities had been denied special education. I think your suggestion that the one case lays on top of the other like a pattern is maybe a little overreaching. It's a more amorphous class in that case, though, isn't it?
Well, I would actually say that was a narrower class because it was only students with learning disabilities as opposed to students in all the categories of disability that were in existence in Wisconsin during the time frame in question, which was at least 10.
Well, there was no expert testimony in that case, and we do have that here, don't we?
Right, and I think the expert testimony, again, if you look at the record in our briefs, was not creditable, and the court committed clear error because the expert looked at a tiny percentage of files of MPS students over a five-year period, some of which was before the time frame in question. She self-selected those files, which I think can be fairly called the worst of the worst, and she looked at 190-some files.
Well, what type of sampling would you suggest with a large school system like MPS?
Well, I don't think you're going to have to do some kind of sampling.
Right.
Just picking out what's she called or we called, and she didn't, and plaintiffs didn't deny this, the worst of the worst files, that's not a fair sampling. And second, the other critical component of her testimony and why it shouldn't have been credited and why the court's reliance on it was clear is because she used the wrong legal standard. And that's what this court just relied on in reversing the Marshall School District ALJ. She said that what she looked for when she was coming up with her opinions was whether or not the students were making educational progress. And that's absolutely not the standard to be considered, either at the referral stage or even if we're considering a later denial of a free appropriate public education.
But you didn't offer expert testimony to rebut her analysis on a number of the points.
Well, we rebutted it through our own experts who didn't do the same type of sampling but talked about the context of these cases and talked about how the suspension histories that you referred to are not a sole trigger for a referral. And we also presented factual testimony at phase two explaining the educator's own professional judgment, which this court has said should be granted deference because they are the educational experts. She never talked to any educator, any teacher, administrator. She never talked to a parent, never talked to a student. She looked at files which she acknowledged were incomplete and drew her conclusions, asked the court to project it over the class, and the court did exactly that. He extrapolated those findings to a class, and there's just simply no basis to do that.
You know, when we talk about the complexity of the remedial process, obviously there will be a lengthy, elaborate process both to identify the class members and to determine the relief appropriate for each class member. But isn't that dictated by the systemic nature of the problems involved by this case and by the number of students that are have been potentially injured? I was thinking about the litigation of the 70s and 80s against United Airlines regarding its old rule that female flight attendants could not marry. That case resulted in a class of more than 1,000 women, and there were literally hundreds of hearings, many which took place years after the fact, to determine whether each putative class member, in fact, was fired or resigned because of the no marriage rule, and thus, therefore, was entitled to relief. And what I really started to wonder about is, how is this case different?
Well, I think it's different in a number of significant ways. First, the United Airlines cases that you referred to talked about a facially illegal policy. In this case, there is no question that the policies are not at issue. In fact, plaintiff's counsel specifically said in their closing argument, MPS's policies are great, and there's never been any question that MPS has policies addressing child find. So since we're not talking about a common factual issue, the distinction, in talking about commonality, is that there are numerous legal and factual distinctions between this case, because whether or not a student had a suspension history which should have triggered a referral has nothing to do legally or factually with whether a parent was invited or was given opportunity to attend an initial IEP team meeting, or whether their IEP, once referred, went beyond the 90-day timeline. So that's a significant difference there. It's also a Title VII case, which has different standards for addressing class actions. And if we were talking about a case that was approved as a systemic violation case, which met the requirements of not just attacking a limited component and that the exhaustion process could not handle, or the administrative process could not handle it, then I think we would be talking about a post-liability, numerous hearings situation, which is common in class actions, because even though there may be common issues of law to establish liability, different plaintiffs' damages are going to differ, so there is the need, and the rules specifically set up a special master who can handle those types of cases. So, yes, well, theoretically, you could have hundreds or thousands of individualized determinations as to what combat award may be appropriate. You don't ever get here in this case. And to the point that raised earlier as to the individualized inquiry, Adeshana says it has to be an easily ascertainable class. This class, just to determine class eligibility, class membership, could cost up to $40 million and involve the hybrid IEP team, a concept, by the way, which is not recognized in the IDEA, making those determinations on a very short timeline. And even then, the district court called that process at least six times in its Phase 3 order a very difficult inquiry and a highly individualized difficult inquiry. So if it takes a team of professional educators relying on their professional judgment and record reviews going back now almost 10 years potentially for some class members, then it doesn't meet any standard of definiteness or easily ascertainable. And this court has said the determination as to who is a class member should only be a ministerial one, and that if it involves more complex issues, then it's not appropriate as a class. I don't think you can think of any other example that shows how difficult it would be to ascertain at least a portion of the class members in this case.
Mr. Aldana, I don't want to spend a lot of time on $40 million figure, but are we talking something in the range of 12?
$12 million?
I mean, don't we have your estimate is that 3,000, right, students would have to be evaluated to be in compliance?
3-2, depending on how many responded
right.
to the class notice.
Isn't it uncontested that it's about $4,000 a student?
That's correct.
So math wasn't my strong suit. That's why I went into
it. The low end is $12 million. The high end is $40 million. And I would suggest that $12 million is a lot of money.
No, I'm not. It's serious money, even in Milwaukee, right?
Right. Yeah. Even in Milwaukee, it's serious money. So if it costs $12 to $40 million to determine just who's in the class, that can't be an ascertainable class.
What's the compensatory award figure?
It's unknowable because it depends on how many class members, how many people who respond are identified as class members. And then even then, talking about difficulty in ascertaining, for some who say, I was never referred and I should have been, then this hybrid IEP team not only has to determine comp ed, first they have to determine whether they, in fact, are eligible for special education, which is a very detailed process which this court just went through in the Marshall case. And even then, they have to determine what the comp ed award would be. And plaintiff's expert at phase three initially said it should be a one-to-one, whatever that means, basis. So time from delay in referring, as though you can ascertain a date and time when somebody is disabled or becomes disabled, which is not an easy task in many of the categories of disability.
Well, and it would have to be done retrospectively.
It would have to be done retrospectively, but
based on records, because you can't take contemporaneous testing done now. I suppose maybe there's a way to do it and extrapolate it backward to determine whether education has been denied.
Yeah, they would have to determine the student's present level of performance and then compare it to if there is a finding that they should have been referred a year ago or 5 years before they were. Then what does it take to get them to where they would have been had that denial not occurred? And that can take many different forms.
Well, the district court didn't require the compensatory education be provided to every class member. It was quite explicit, it seems to me, in limiting that relief to those class members whom the hybrid IEP team determines were worse off as a result of the IDEA violations in this case. And it said that the nature and amount of compensatory education was to be based on each person's particular circumstances. So what is your real complaint about the award of compensatory relief?
I don't know that theoretically we have a complaint about the potential award of comp ed. I think the complaint is based on a number of factors. One, it's what I've just spent a lot of time talking about, the ascertainment of who is in that class.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. If you're not I mean, if you're not I guess what I don't get is the real complaint here.
Well, the real complaint is that the Phase 2 liability findings should have never been made because the plaintiffs who have the burden of proof in these cases failed to carry that burden of proof, and the district court primarily relied on anecdotal evidence or the expert's testimony, which I just mentioned, was not credible in making those findings. And if you look at it as compared to the typical ALJ findings or district court findings, and again, the Marshall case provides a perfect example. That case took thousands of pages of a transcript and a 62-page district court decision just for eligibility. And the district court never went through anything remotely close to that analysis and never found that any specific plaintiff, class representative, or class member was ever denied FAPE. So without a finding of a denial of a free appropriate public education, there is no Phase 3 remedy. So that's one of our big beefs with it. The second part of it is that it creates this redundant, what he calls a parallel system, to what's already in existence at MPS and under the IDEA, and it creates this permanent hybrid IEP team, which, as I mentioned earlier, has no basis under the IDEA, and the district court even excused the requirement that it be a properly constituted IEP team, and we don't think that a non-properly constituted IEP team should be making the kind of core eligibility determination that the IDEA considers. And so there are several parts of the remedial order, the first of which there is no basis for. And if I could just say, the district court at Phase 3 acknowledged at Phase 3 that the class representatives had not proven their case because the plaintiffs in their proposed remedy sought not only the creation of this system for the unnamed class members, but sought specific compensatory ed awards for the class or the plaintiffs. And the court said he's not going to do that because they never brought an educational expert forward to say that they had reviewed the records, spoken to the student, and determined that a denial of FAPE warranting a comp ed award had ever been proven to the court. So that alone should have ended the Phase 3 remedy because the plaintiffs and the district court acknowledges the plaintiffs had the burden of proof of establishing the need for a compensatory education system. They didn't. So, again, there's a Phase 2 failing of evidence to support a finding of liability, and there's a Phase 3 failing of evidence to support the need for that kind of system.
Perhaps this is very simplistic, but the more I read, the more I thought about Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. And when I came upon the brief of the amicus curiae, State of Wisconsin, Department of Public Instruction, in support of the plaintiffs and appellees, I just truly began to think, why in God's name are we continuing on with this? Is there no way to come to a happy conclusion without the state versus the city, the district court, you know, and the appeals court, and all of you? Is there no way that someone couldn't sit everyone down and say, we all want to do the right thing here?
That has happened on dozens of occasions at pre-litigation stage, Phase 1 and Phase 2 stages, Phase 3 stages, and then post-Phase 3. There have been numerous lengthy full-day mediation sessions, and the parties, while we would like this case to have been resolved a long time ago as well, we've not been able to come to a meeting of the minds, and it's just not been, without getting into the details of it.
If you had to pick one or two points that are absolutely impassable for you, what would those two be?
Well, the class that was certified and the class that is potentially up for compensatory awards includes regular education students with suspension histories And we just believe that that drags in the entire population of MPS potentially into this special ed case. So we have not been able to get over that hurdle. The district court, in its phase three findings, said we need to screen for eligibility students with suspension histories, even though it never defined what a suspension history, and even though it acknowledged that a suspension history itself is not a trigger for a referral. So the problem is that this case has mushroomed well beyond the scope of how it was pled originally, or even the class definition that the circuit court or the district court certified.
What about all the young people who are long past the possibility of being part of the class?
Well, I would respond by saying we don't know that there are all the young people that the plaintiffs have raised the specter of. And so that's a failing on the plaintiff's part of carrying their burden of proof and a failing on the district court's part, because we don't know that there are all these students. And we think it very unlikely that you would have an entire generation of a number or hundreds or thousands of students who had a disability throughout their entire educational career and were never referred. And although it's not the parents' obligation to make the referral, it's the LEAs, the local educational agencies, responsibility to identify, locate, and evaluate students with a disability, there's no question, particularly since this litigation has commenced, this has been blared all over the Milwaukee Public Schools. It's in the handbook, parent handbook that comes out every year, both the notice of the litigation as well as a general statement saying, if you think your child needs special education, here's the numbers to contact. So there is no factual basis to say there are hundreds or thousands of students who may be denied a free appropriate public education because they didn't come forward on a timely basis.
Well, if there's a systemic failure, and of course I know, Mr. Aldana, you would not agree to that. If there's a systemic failure, the fact that many, let's say, scores, if not hundreds, that pass through the system and aren't identified, how big a fear do you have about an enormous compensatory award?
Well, I mean, if we're talking that's just about one component of the system, the unidentified students. You know, you also have the students who will claim they at some point were identified, but they weren't done so on a timely basis, and we should get some compensatory award. You've got the students whose IEPs went beyond 90 days, or the students who, and I don't know how they would make a showing of the need for a comp ed award, for whose parents didn't attend the initial IEP team meeting. So while I think that the universe of potential class members in that category is fairly small, it's still not known at this time.
Well, but under, again, just assuming arguendo for a second, if you have a systemic failure, that's an inevitability, isn't it, if there is such a class?
Well, we would contend there's not a systemic failure.
And
but if I could just point out a few reasons why. If we're talking about the district doesn't refer students, that is a limited component of the IDEA. But it's so it wouldn't meet the definition of systemic. But even if that was somehow not a limited component, the statistics show to the contrary. And we pointed this out in our briefs. It was a stipulated fact before the trial court that MPS's referral rates, that is the percentage of students who are referred for a special education evaluation, are consistently higher than national and state averages. So to suggest that MPS doesn't refer students with disabilities on a systemic basis is just not borne out by the facts. And for those numbers that aren't or haven't been or claim to not have been, that's what the exhaustion requirement is there for, to handle those. And ALJs in Wisconsin routinely handle those, and that's another important component of whether this is a systemic violation, whether the administrative process can resolve these complaints. The district court noted in its order a couple of times in its orders that the plaintiffs never alleged that the administrative process in Wisconsin was broken or couldn't handle it. Now, in their briefs, they say, well, it would be futile to do that, but they point to no evidence to suggest that. And these are the types of cases, whether it's late identification, late referral, late IEP teams, parental participation, that ALJs routinely handle. And there's no evidence that whatever number of students may come forward with a due process hearing, that couldn't be handled at the state level. And that's what the IDEA intends. You look at the Marshall case, you look at that individualized inquiry. How can you do that on a class-wide basis? other than to create this parallel system, which is a redundancy.
How much money will the state of Wisconsin save by doing it your way rather than the plaintiff's way?
The state versus Milwaukee Public Schools? We don't have a number for that. I mean, clearly the MPS wouldn't have to pay that initial class membership eligibility component, but that doesn't address whether or not comp ed is awarded, whether or not and what the cost would be. We don't have that number because we don't know who's in the class, and so it's impossible to ascertain that. And even then, because of the individualized inquiries, it's going to be a lot of different results depending on where the student is now, how long the alleged delay was. It's not quantifiable at this point.
Is there any federal money that will be offered?
I don't know if there's any specially directed federal money for this. There's no evidence that the Department of Education has come forward and said, we'll pay for this implementation of it. In fact, I can say that there is no at this point, and I don't think there's been any request made of the USDOE. We know that DPI isn't going to be funding it. They are on board with the plaintiffs.
Thank you, Ms. Aldana.
Thank you.
Mr. Spitzer-Resnick?
Thank you, Your Honor. All of you, good morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
My name is Jeff Spitzer-Resnick. I'm with Disability Rights Wisconsin. My co-counsel, Monica Murphy, will cover the issues of liability, remedial order, and the DPI settlement. I will deal with the issues of jurisdiction and class certification. I think because most of the questions have been on class certification, I'm going to move straight there. Of course, if you have any questions, Judge Sykes, on jurisdiction, I'll be glad to answer them.
I'm saving those for the next case.
Fair enough. I'll be back.
I know you will.
First question in any appeal, of course, is what's the standard of review? And when it comes to class certification, it's important to note that this circuit has found in the Mira case that district court has broad discretion to determine whether to certify a class, and that decision will only be reversed for an abuse of discretion. Now, it is also true that the question of whether exhaustion is waived is a de novo law. The question of whether or not exhaustion applies, is a de novo issue. But whether it is waived is in the district court's discretion and will only be reversed for an abuse of discretion. It's important to look at two key definitions in this case. First, what was the class certified by the court? And I'll just read it because it's short. Those students eligible for special education services for MPS who are, have been, or will be either denied or delayed entry or participation in the processes which result in a properly constituted meeting between the IEP team and the parents or guardians of the student. Now, that's important for a couple of reasons. Mr. Aldana has spoken quite a bit about FAPE denial. This is the classic procedural case. It is about a systemic denial of a process that thousands of children were entitled to and were denied.
Except what's the legal standard that triggers the process?
My second quote from the Child Find Obligation, which is at 42 U.S.C. 1412 sub A sub 3 sub capital A. The state of Wisconsin, which is why they were initially sued, we, of course, have come to a settlement with them, and MPS have an obligation to have a system in place, not just individual one at a time, but to have a system in place so that, and I quote, all children with disabilities who are in need of special education and related services are identified, located, and evaluated. As Mr. Aldana conceded, this is not a parental obligation. While, of course, parents can and, in fact, do, and many of our clients made repeated referrals. That's how bad the system was. They made repeated requests to have their children identified and evaluated, ignored. Kids flunking out of school or socially promoted by concession of MPS year after year, despite, in some of those cases, parental requests, still not evaluated. The key question here is, why are we here? We're here because, despite a systemic failure denying the rights of thousands of children over nearly a decade, MPS has chosen to litigate this thing, as Judge Rovner quite rightly pointed out, forever. And here we are. And then the next question is, and it's, I hope it, whether it's in the next argument, I'm not sure, I couldn't tell from the lights whether there's rebuttal time, that you'll ask Mr. Aldana. If this isn't a class action under the IDEA, and it's interesting reading the defendant's briefs, because they can't argue there's no such thing as a class action, a systemic exception to exhaustion, because look around. There's plenty of cases that show that there are class actions. Even Adeshannis, the case that they rely on, doesn't say there can be no class action. It just, as you point out, Judge Gorham, finds a lot of flaws, which we can go over if we need to, but a lot of flaws in that plaintiff's case. So the question for defendants is, if this, with all the evidence, and it's not just our expert who they criticize, but they failed to have anybody analyze what she analyzed, it's the plethora of evidence from the state, their own complaint process, their own monitoring process. You've got charts in the appendices, which are only limited selections, showing massive systemic violations, orders from the state. Fix the problem, MPS. Oh, you're not fixing it? Fix it again. We told you to fix it again. Oh, you're not fixing it? Now we're going to invent this thing in Wisconsin called a consolidated corrective action plan. Why is it consolidated? Because there's so many violations, so many orders. Even MPS complained to the state, we don't know which order we're supposed to follow. Okay, MPS, we'll make it easy for you. We'll consolidate them. One big package of all your violations. If that's not systemic, and if that's not exhaustion of administrative remedies, Your Honor, I think this court would actually have to find that there is no availability for class actions under the IDEA. And, of course, no case has said that.
Well, what would be wrong with such a holding?
What would be wrong with such a holding? Well, the best way to look at that would be to look at the requirement that states and local districts have this system in place of child fine that works.
Right. Well, the child fine obligation does relate to an obligation to, on the part of the LEA, to develop a system of making these identifications and referrals. But
right.
The referral decisions themselves are highly individualized.
Exactly.
And the point of the system is to get the referrals made.
So let's
and
pause.
So that's what makes this an inappropriate subject for the class action device, because the crux of the matter is that each of the referral decisions that triggers the 90-day obligation and all of the other IEP obligations is a highly individualized decision about whether there is reason to believe that an individual child is in need of special education.
True, but let me put it to you this way. Given that this system is a legal obligation, if we can't bring a class action, and the state tried for years through all its various tools, even threatening and implementing withdrawal of funds to MPS, still can't fix it, what remedy is there? The answer, apparently, is none to fixing a system.
The
because
state can withdraw the funds.
Does that fix the system? Apparently not.
But that's the remedy that's specified in the statutory scheme.
It's
the
not.
Money flows to the state and then from the state to the local education associations or agencies to implement systems. Nobody argues that there isn't a system. There's a question about its adequacy, but the adequacy depends upon this highly subjective and individualized determination child by child as to whether a referral was made at the appropriate time based on a reason to believe that the child was in need of special education services, and then the evaluation proceeded accordingly from there to either confer or deny the services.
Well, let me put it two ways. One is, I think what you've suggested is exactly why, rather than the court substituting its judgment about eligibility for any child, including the named plaintiffs, which we have not appealed those decisions, okay, substituted it by actually adopting one of defendants' experts' suggestions. Dr. Hartwig suggested the hybrid IEP team. Why? Because the court recognized, yes, ultimately, just like in the stewardess case, you have to make individualized decisions. And the other response I would give to you, Judge Sykes, is play it further. What if MPS just said, you know what, we're not going to do this at all. We're not going to identify anyone. And what if the state spent, as it had, 5, 10, 15 years trying to get MPS to do its job? Is the response simply the plaintiffs really have no systemic ability to change the system? The congressional record dictates otherwise. Every other circuit who's ruled on this has dictated otherwise. So this would be, if following the logic that you've laid out, that there is no class action under the IDEA, the first case in the land that found that. No other case has found that. Now, the other thing that's important to understand, because MPS likes to try to parse child find as just this kind of procedural small thing, it is the gateway to the IDEA. Without this system of child find, there is no IDEA. There is no special ed. You can't get in the door. And while MPS is correct that not every child, and we've certainly conceded this throughout, not every child who is denied an appropriate evaluation, A, is eligible, or B, is entitled to compensatory education. But where they are completely wrong is suggesting that we haven't proven that FAPE was denied. If FAPE means you must have an IEP, you cannot get, according to the IDEA, a free appropriate public education if there is no IEP.
Well, where students experienced a delay rather than a denial of entry into the IEP process, why not require those individuals to exhaust their administrative remedies, given that they are in the IEP process and they have the ability to pursue relief administratively for any injury that was suffered as a result of the delay?
I think there's two reasons for that, Your Honor. And the first goes back to the systemic nature of that violation as well. We demonstrated that there were dozens, if not hundreds, of kids in that circumstance. And if the system is broken, particularly in a school district the size of MPS with thousands of kids involved, it is not an effective and efficient use. And that's the whole purpose of exhaustion and class actions. How do we effectively and efficiently apply remedies to a systemic violation? And the answer in that case is not to make dozens or hundreds of children go through a due process. Some of those delays, Your Honor, were nearly a year, multiple years, and in some cases, they actually fit into both. So, for example, a child whose parent repeatedly requested to have an IEP meeting and an evaluation didn't happen, and then it eventually happens, let's say 3 years later, and there were cases like this, and then they still don't fit the statutory timeline. Well, are we going to say, oh, well, now they should exhaust because 3 years later they finally got the process, even though that took longer than the then applicable 90 days?
But the point is that they could have exhausted when the request for the referral was originally ignored. That triggers
they could have, but as, and I can't remember if it was Judge Rovner or Judge Flom who asked the question previously, how would they have known? Okay, in theory,
they get notices about the availability of due process multiple times.
What, children who made a request and it's ignored? No, they don't get a notice.
The parents of children in the school district get notice about the availability of special ed services.
Nothing in that notice says that they have a right to go seek a due process hearing if their request is ignored. Nothing,
See,
Your Honor, with all due respect.
My problem is that the class period closed in 2005.
Which was purely an evidentiary issue. I mean, the court had to, for purposes of going to trial, say, we've got to end discovery somewhere. The first phase of the trial happened in 06, so the court said, okay, we're cutting discovery off June of 05, therefore evidence stopped then, too.
So then is it fair to say that most of the class members are adults by the time the relief will be awarded?
Sadly, in many cases, that is probably true. However, and this wasn't cited because it really wasn't argued by either side, but it is clearly the law that the IDEA permits compensatory education post the age of eligibility if a violation of rights is shown. So I don't think we have an issue. Now, back to the complaint about money, it is absolutely relevant, and we are sadly confident that the thousands of children they're expecting to come forward, given time, mobility, poverty, their only obligation under the court's order would send a notice to the last known address, many of which we know will come back, return to sender. There's no obligation the district court gave, nor did we argue to go hire an investigator and go find these people.
So
that's too bad, but it's the reality of lengthy litigation and... But, you know.
So you have no updated guess as to how many people would now meet the class definition?
Your Honor, I have nothing on the record. I can tell you my co-counsel and I would be thrilled if 1,000 class members' families came forward. We would be thrilled. We don't even expect a number that high. It's not on the record, pure educational guesswork from having done this kind of work for 25 years. And, you know, I think we did cite in some of the jurisdictional argument on motions to dismiss, or no, it was back on the stay issue, excuse me, you know, some law review articles about there's a limited, you know, if you get 10% to respond in a consumer class action, that's fairly high. I think it's time for Ms. Murphy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spitzer. Resnick. Ms. Murphy.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Monica Murphy, and I'm going to be talking about the issues of the settlement with DPI, liability, and the remedy orders in this case. And I'm going to start with the DPI settlement because I think it harkens back to some of the other issues. The MPS has contested the settlement with DPI on several fronts, most significantly on the belief that it somehow affects their legal rights, when basically, as you have seen as well from the amicus directly from the state, that the state settlement gives the simply puts the court's imprimatur on what rights the state already had.
I thought the regulatory scheme vested DPI with the authority in the case of systemic violations to order the LEA to develop a corrective action plan and submit it to the state as a collaborative process, as I understand the regulatory scheme, and then the DPI, after receipt of the corrective action plan from the LEA, either approves it or disapproves it, or it's modified in the context of that collaborative process and then imposed. So it's essentially from the bottom up, as opposed to the top down, and MPS was cut out of this because it was a settlement between DPI and your clients?
Except that whole corrective action process had been going on for a number of years to no avail.
Well, I'm aware of that. The record demonstrates that very clearly. But the authority of the DPI is not unilateral, as I understand it. It's to initiate a collaborative process with the local education agency to directed at correcting whatever systemic problems may exist in the system or individual problems that may exist.
And believe me, that has been going on since.
Right, but that's not what went on in the settlement, and that's the complaint. The precise complaint here is that MPS was cut out and is now being ordered by DPI to do things that DPI doesn't have the authority to order. DPI has the authority to withhold funds. DPI has the authority to order an LEA to develop a corrective action plan and to reject the one that's developed as a remedy, or ask that it be modified in certain ways, and then once it's, you know, in the shape that everybody wants it to be in as part of this collaborative process, it's put in place and implemented. And this settlement agreement cannot be characterized as that.
Well, the settlement agreement is a settlement of a class action litigation, and defendants and part of a negotiation between the
point is that it exceeds DPI's authority. DPI cannot give away, in exchange for getting itself out of this case, rights it doesn't have. That's the point. DPI doesn't have the right to impose the line items in the settlement agreement that it promised to impose.
Well, it has the authority to
ask
have
for
a
corrective action plan, not impose one unilaterally. Unless I'm misreading the regulatory scheme. If I am, I'm happy to be corrected, but I don't think I'm misreading the regulatory scheme. Tell me if I'm not reading it correctly.
I don't know. You're the judge. You get to say.
Well, you should have anticipated this argument.
Maybe I could put it in a little different way. Maybe not, but maybe. Why doesn't MPS have standing to object to the settlement, given that the benchmarks that DPA has agreed to will be imposed on MPS itself? In other words, what if the plaintiffs and DPI agreed to require benchmarks that in MPS's view was impossible for it to attain? Who but MPS ought to have standing to object to those benchmarks? And I think,
But the benchmarks are even less than what IDEA requires. MPS would have the obligation to do those things regardless, because IDEA doesn't have you get a percent pass on 5% of the kids. IDEA requires that they do these things for all the kids. So what the settlement imposes is actually something less than what IDEA requires, and the court even recognized that in his orders, that he wasn't necessarily satisfied with what the compromise between the plaintiff's counsel and DPI had in terms of the 95% benchmarks.
Well, if DPI has the power to impose on MPS the benchmarks that were set forth in the settlement agreement, what could possibly prevent the district court from approving the settlement?
Well, as the state has said, even if the court didn't approve the settlement, they were still going to impose these requirements on DPI or on MPS, because it was within their authority as the state education agency to make those requirements. DPI has realized for a long time that the problems in MPS are systemic. They have the corrective action plans, the consolidated corrective action plans, the on-site monitoring. They monitored MPS far more often than did any other district in the state. The SOAP plan that they developed and imposed on MPS, the SIFM plan, whole series of steps that DPI took because they realized that there were significant systemic problems in the way MPS was handling special education.
Bottom line, what's your real complaint about the award of compensatory relief?
Our complaint about it? We don't have a complaint with awarding compensatory damages. We think that the MPS exaggerates what compensatory damages could ultimately be, but we don't object to the fact that the court said that kids need to be determined whether they should have compensatory services or not.
None. Is that the bottom line answer?
To the question of whether we object to the remedy order?
Yeah,
we don't have an objection to that. We have not appealed the remedy order. And I did want to get back to some of the issues about what evidence the court did have about systemic problems in MPS. Dr. Rogers' Atkinson report was just one of many things. I already listed off the number of items that arose out of DPI's monitoring, the corrective action plans, the monitoring. But even the records themselves from MPS that show untimely special education evaluations for hundreds of kids, and some of those evaluations being hundreds of days overdue. What was the average? There were a couple different time periods that we got statistics for. For one time period, I think the average was 30 days. For another time period, it was 37 days. But there were kids who went for years. And what is also very troubling is hundreds of kids whose cases were closed without getting to the evaluation and without any clear record of why that happened. It just shows up in the MPS database as case closed. So there would have been a referral for those kids. Somebody suspected that this child had a disability. There was some kind of, you know, triggering of that initial step, and then the case was closed before it got to the actual evaluation.
In the 9 years, so many of these kids, I mean, they're gone.
Unfortunately, yes.
And nobody knows where they are.
Correct. And if you look through the orders on the remedy and things, there is a scheme set out for attempting to give class notice and doing what we could to find those kids. But I think in reality, especially as time goes by and as the court pointed out, justice delayed is justice denied. There are a lot of kids whose rights are violated who will never have any remedy of it. And that's the unfortunate nature of litigation.
Do we know how many individuals we started out with? I'm just so trying to get a handle on numbers because I'm compulsive.
I think that's very difficult to say, in part because started out with where? I mean, at the time we filed, how many kids had been overlooked, it's very difficult to say. We have numbers in terms of kids who had untimely evaluations. We have numbers in terms of kids who were suspended 10 or more days in any given school year. That number's in the 10,000 area, I believe. But as we said, that doesn't necessarily mean, just because your child is repeatedly suspended doesn't necessarily mean that that's a child in need of special education. But the whole remedy scheme involves screening and looking, taking a second look at those kids. That was part of the settlement with DPI, too. Kids who are failing. Well, let's look at those kids and see, is there something more going on here? That's not a whole special education evaluation with convening a whole IEP team. It's a let's just stop here and take a look at these kids and see if there's something else going on. And if there is, then we may proceed to a special.
The problem is that doesn't satisfy the legal standard for a referral. The legal standard for a referral requires reason to believe, individualized reason to believe, that this is a child in need of special education. And to categorically say that students with a suspension history and to categorically say that students who are held back a year.
We aren't saying that they have to be referred. We're saying that they need to be screened. And that's Dr. Tucker.
But that presupposes that they should have been referred based on that categorization alone. And that's not the remedial scheme or the services delivery scheme that the IDEA sets up. It doesn't set up categories of students who are presumptively entitled to a referral. And in order to...
But we're not saying that they need to be referred. What we're saying, Ed, is look at these kids.
Right. You're saying that they maybe should have been referred because they were suspended and because they were held back. And that establishes a presumption that is nowhere in the statute.
No, we're saying they should have been looked at.
What's the difference between that and referral?
Referral doesn't come in until you suspect a disability. But to do an adequate job of child find, you need some kind of across-the-board screening, and that's what Dr. Tucker talked about. And that's what's part of the prospective remedy we have with CPI, is across-the-board screening of kids with behavior problems, kids who are failing in reading, kids who are failing in math.
Well, Ms. Murphy, let me just, I don't want to interrupt you, but time is short. I don't have statistics on MPS, and perhaps I'm a little more familiar with the CPS, Chicago Public Schools. But is it your position that if we have a major metropolitan school system in anywhere in this country, where we have 30 to 35% of a class below the reading level that's anticipated, are you suggesting that there's a legal obligation to focus on every one of those students? And I guess I would ask you how that focus would come about. Is it monthly or quarterly or whatever? In anticipation of a potential referral, is that what you're suggesting?
Sort of. I mean, the IDEA talks about early intervening services and response to interventions. Okay, those are things that apply to regular ed kids. That's not the kids who are already in special ed. That's regular ed kids. Let's look at these kids. Let's not accept that 35% of the kids can't read at grade level. If we see kids who are in that category, let's look at them and see.
Is that a look beyond, let's say, what the teacher leader is hopefully doing each day or weekly? I mean, I'm trying to look at what additional layer would be called upon, in your view, to be implemented prior to the referral process.
Well, I think you do need to ensure that the teachers are really looking at that and really looking at the kids to see what's going on. It's what happened too often with so many of these kids was pass them on.
Well,
get them
I,
on
I
here.
I appreciate
not
the general
problem.
Criticisms of education, but we're challenged here with trying to focus on a potential class and what direction a district court or sanction a court of appeals should give to it. And I guess what's giving me a little pause is perhaps the sweep of your suggestion of where that obligation of the school system lies.
Well, I think the IDEA's requirement for early intervening services
Would we be about then if we had a 5-year history of 35% below reading level, then have an obligation to look at teacher competence in monitoring if the figure suggested no improvement, let's say, in that regard?
Absolutely. I think that's kind of what No Child Left Behind is about. You know, if kids are not succeeding, then we need to look at the way we're teaching them and what kinds of, you know, programs we're using and the teacher competency and the whole methodology.
That all may be true as a matter of education policy, but this is a court case which is subject to some legal standards. And the federal courts aren't in the business of running educational institutions.
Which is why...
Or implementing education policy. And everything that you've said about the problems with MPS, you know, I can accept
and
know
to
be true.
Well, and they're addressing the prospective remedy, and I guess the court's kind of not having to deal with that. I mean, the prospective remedy is doing those kinds of things. The remedy that we're asking for MPS is really the retrospect, the compensatory education for the kids whose rights have been violated. Fixing the system for the future is part of the resolution we've already agreed to with DPI and the corrective action or the compliance plan that has been developed by DPI and the independent monitor.
So would you say under the remedial direction that's contained in this litigation, there would be an obligation to monitor not just specific referral situations, whether or not they're taking place and being carried out, but there's a greater overview responsibility of the MPS to see if statistically, using my 35% figure, Ms. Murphy, that there's improvement in
there is a whole several tier system structured set up across this several year plan that involves early intervening services for kids who are having reading problems, for kids who are having math problems, and for kids who are having behavioral problems. And it's all part of a broader compliance plan that DPI is imposing on MPS. Part of it involves a subset that is a result of this litigation, but part of it is a broader compliance plan that DPI is.
Thank you. Mr. Aldana, I think ran out of time, but let me just check. There is no time, but we've been asking questions of everyone pretty extensively. It's significant litigation. You may have an additional 5 minutes.
First, let me address a factual error that Ms. Murphy just said. Your question was, is there anything under the Phase 3 remedy scheme which goes beyond individualized compensatory education awards and assessments and onto some kind of systemic oversight? The answer is there is none. What she was referring to and may have erred was the corrective action plan imposed on MPS through the settlement agreement. The district court specifically said there is no need for a systemic overhaul, and I'm not quoting, but that's what he said. He created this parallel system, but it's only focused on individualized inquiries.
So you would say then, is that an argument in favor of class or against class?
But,
I mean, my concern by my inquiry is what the parameters of the remedial action are. That's all.
And, well, in this case, I'm not conceding anything because we don't think factually there is any showing made that we had a systemic breakdown
that.
Or that it was broken. That's belied by the referrals statistics that I gave earlier. Mr. Spitzer-Resnick said that we were doing this on a systemic basis and there were hundreds or thousands of cases in each category. Well, that's just not borne out either by the statistics. The IEP timeline compliance, while it's true that the numbers cited in the reports did go over, MPS was in the mid to upper 90s during most of this time, percentile of timely complying with the 90-day requirement. Similarly with the parental participation. So it's just not factually based to suggest that MPS's components, just limited components of the child find, were broken or non-existent. This isn't a case that MPS didn't have, as plaintiffs acknowledge, policies. This isn't a case where we're talking 30, 40, 50% non-compliance. This is a case where the plaintiffs should acknowledge that there was a system in place, that it was doing enough to meet what the IDEA requires of SEAs, substantial compliance with the IDEA. That, of course, doesn't mean that the percentage that didn't fall into that category of compliance have no remedy. That's what the remedial system is set up for individual cases to be remedied by going through the due process hearing.
What notices are given to MPS parents about the special ed services and how to make requests for them and essentially trigger the system, and then also what their rights are?
Well, there's several categories of information. At the early childhood level, MPS gets out to daycare centers, hospitals, anywhere that a lot of young children will have contact with, the availability of child find. They also give them notice of the availability of special education in the parent handbook, which goes out every year. That's a constant presence on the MPS website. And during the pendency of this litigation, there's been notices in every school in the newspapers. So that goes to the more generic, if you think your child has problems, he or she may need a special ed referral. At the initiation of a referral process, MPS gives out, and there's no evidence to the contrary, the specific statutorily required notice of rights that specifically says if you have a complaint, you can file a due process hearing request. And now, since 2004, IDEA talks about the early resolution, how they have to meet with the school district, lay out with specifics what their complaints are. So that's the kind of notice the parents get at the outset.
Here's my problem. Since you stood up again, MPS contends that the plan has established none of the four criteria for relief for systemic IDEA problems, right?
In this case, they did not.
Okay. But it seems obvious, both from a review of the district court's 64-page opinion that was issued in September of 2007. That was at that conclusion of the Phase 2 trial, as well as prior opinions regarding class certification, that court found each of those criteria had been satisfied. First, the court found that the child fine is not merely a limited component of the special education system, but rather a key component that determines whether and when an eligible student will enter the system. And the evidence seemed to reveal what common sense would suggest, that denial or delays of entry into the system will have profound effects on a student's ability to realize his or her potential. Secondly, the court, when it certified the class, found that violations of the child fine obligations were not amenable to resolution in the administrative process. And then third, the court quite clearly found in that 11th of September decision that there were multiple systemic problems that resulted in the failure to identify or delay in the court, agreed with the defendants that MPS had made significant strides in rectifying some of the problems, and particularly that complying with the 90-day requirement, and it also found that the problems had not been solved completely. Given MPS's history, they would not be solved without judicial oversight. But finally, to the extent that MPS is challenging the sufficiency of the evidence underlying the district court's findings, its challenge fails. The district court quite clearly set forth the evidentiary basis for its findings. And to the extent that the MPS has attacked the rationale of Dr. Rogers' Atkinson's testimony, the district court observed at several points that the defendants had not rebutted her key conclusions with its own experts. So if anything, I think I'm a little more mixed up than I was coming in.
I'm sorry if I haven't made that clear, but I think it is clear that the district court did commit clear error. In one, because it never applied the right legal standard. It never required the plaintiffs to show an actual denial of FAPE. And I don't think, and this court has recognized, a procedural violation.
An actual denial of
a free, appropriate public education. We had class representatives in this case who presented their cases. The district court never said X class representative should have been referred on X date, and I find that the intervening time period when they were referred constituted a denial of a free, appropriate public education. That's a predicate finding before you can establish liability. And that carries out throughout the entire, all four areas of liability. And to answer your question, isn't this a systemic issue? The courts that have dealt with this have not just focused on, are we talking about 50 cases or 100 cases? They've talked about what's behind those cases. And so when you look at the statistics on referral, timeline compliance, it's not, and the plaintiffs acknowledge, it's not an overarching policy. What we're talking about is alleged failures of implementation on an individualized basis.
So, bottom line, you would like to see all of this disappear and to start over 9 years ago, or obviously with new individuals, and hold one after another administrative hearing?
Well, yes, we think that all the four areas that we're appealing were erroneously decided, and therefore the entire case should be dismissed. Whether plaintiffs want to, and they never, except for two of the early named plaintiffs, never brought administrative hearings. Those two, they did bring hearings or due process hearing requests. Those were settled, which is what the IDEA contemplates. None of the named representatives filed a request, even though they were post-referral claims. They never explained why. The district court never asked them to explain why. If the plaintiffs want to file a new case or individual cases that are within the statute of limitations, they can. I can't say why they didn't earlier. They chose to hope that the district court would certify a class and hope that this court appeals. No, early on, even before there was any phase two liability. That was the phase two liability finding was made in 2007. This case was filed in 2001. It was 6 years for the plaintiffs to file individual claims, which I think could have shown whether or not the administrative system worked. They didn't want to, I think, because it would have worked.
Surely you're not saying that they didn't because they didn't want it to work.
No, that would have been evidence to support their claim, the claim that they're only now making on appeal, that the administrative process was futile. If they had filed a dozen or 50 or 100 and it swamped the system, which in other cases has been a grounds for excusing the exhaustion requirement, then they could have said, oh, by the way, district court, we have met another element of the systemic exception, that is that the administrative process is inadequate to address the issues. That never happened here.
The administrative process didn't come to a dead end. There were still cases being brought through the administrative system.
Sure, but none of the, certainly not these plaintiffs' counsel, other than the Jim M. and Lamont, did not, as far as I know, and maybe there were a couple, but we certainly didn't see 50 or 100 or 200 cases in the categories that we're talking about that are at issue in this case. And so, as the district court noted, there's no allegation that the administrative process couldn't work. And it created this pre- and post-determination distinction based on exhaustion. Three of the four categories, even using its logic, should have been required to exhaust because he based his decision on whether the parents had knowledge of their rights to appeal. Well, obviously, anybody who's after a referral, any problems that come up after a referral is made, had notice of their rights to appeal. And then as to who should have been referred but wasn't, that's a kind of individualized inquiry that is not susceptible, particularly where it's not a result of an alleged policy on MPS's part. That's a kind of individualized inquiry which is not susceptible to Class 23 treatment. Rule 23 is a procedural vehicle only. It doesn't relieve the plaintiffs from establishing their burden of proof. It doesn't alter the party's substantive rights either in making a claim, proving a claim, or the defendant's rights in holding the
plaintiff. So, Don, we're running late, but I do want to make one final inquiry. I certainly don't want to cut off my sisters. But is it your position that the magistrate Goodstein's consideration of Melanie, Ryan, Nathan, obviously Jamie, the name, and Brian, together with this checklist of 10% noncompliance and the behavioral assessments by the experts, just that's the package that fails of proof here?
That's among the package, part of the package that the plaintiffs failed to prove.
What else did he consider? What have I left out of his consideration?
Well,
the testimony of the experts?
The three class representatives, if you're just focused on them, they were all referred for special education and all found eligible. So they weren't in that category of non-referrals. And we have no, and I think some of the panel members have asked, what numbers are we looking at who were never referred? We don't know. They never established that. You can't base a liability finding of a systemic violation if you don't have that kind of factual predicate.
All right. Thank you. Let me just make sure we have no other questions. I guess not. Thank you. I would normally thank all counsel, but I'm going to thank you at the end of the next argument. So you, thank you for so far, but we're going to go to the next case now. And obviously –